This morning we're going to be in Job 16 and 17. And while you're turning there, I'd like for you to think about this passage. Romans 6, 16 through 18 says this: "Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves to the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in righteousness? But thanks be to God that though you were slaves to sin, you became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching to which you were committed, and having been freed from sin, you became slaves of righteousness." I want you to think this morning about what it means to be a slave of righteousness. What is that like? Well, it means that God has got you, and that there is nothing at all that you can do. There's nowhere else that you can go. God is going to work His purpose in your life, and it is the purpose of righteousness. You're the slave, and the master will have His way. Even if you don't like it, that's what God is doing. Even when you don't like it, because there will be some times. That's what it means to be a slave of righteousness. Now, we're going to see this morning something that you may already know, that is what it's like for every believer. We're not in control. Even when we fail to appreciate what God is doing in our lives through the circumstances that He sends our way, He does it for His purposes. Sometimes we don't like it. Sometimes we don't understand it. Sometimes we think we would rather see God do it some other way. But God knows what He's doing. Now, as we look at these two chapters of the book of Job, written more than 4,000 years ago, or they took place then, we don't know who wrote it down, we're going to see that this is exactly how it was then. Some people were slaves of sin. Some people were slaves of righteousness. Job's three friends demonstrate in this book what it is like for those who have not become obedient from the heart by the gracious work of God in their lives. And Job shows what it's like to be a slave of righteousness. Job's going to point out some of the problems with their lives in his speech today. And then we're going to see in his life this thing that Romans calls being a slave of righteousness. Now, we're in the middle of an argument between these guys, middle of a conflict that's been going on for a while. Job and his three friends are on opposite sides of the argument. The three friends are convinced that they can produce righteousness for themselves, that they can take this thing that they produce and lay it before God on the last day, and that God will accept it. Job, on the other hand, is convinced that righteousness comes from God alone, and if you don't get it from Him, you don't have any. The circumstances of life are an important factor in understanding this book as well. The three friends are in the very best possible position as far as life circumstances go. They have status, comfort, wealth, good health. Their lives are going well. Nothing bad is happening to them during the main part of this book. And so as we look at their lives and we consider their philosophy that they can produce righteousness for themselves, we're evaluating their position in the very best of times, the best possible setting. If it won't work for them, in the midst of wealth and comfort and privilege and status and power and good health, then it won't work. And no one should trust that system. If it proves empty and vain in the very best of times, then it is empty and vain all the time, and nobody should ever trust it. Job, on the other hand, is in the very worst possible circumstance as far as his life is going during the bulk of this book. He used to have all the stuff that these guys have. He had more of it than they have, wealth and power and comfort, health. And then he lost all of it. His kids died violently, all of them in a day. His wealth was all destroyed in a day. And then he lost his health. During most of this story, Job is in absolute agony physically. His condition is extremely painful, and it's going on for a long, long time. He has no tangible hope that he's ever going to be healthy again, ever have a family again, ever have any resources or any comforts ever again. And so as we look at Job's life and his philosophy, we're evaluating what he thinks at the very worst possible moment of human experience. If his view of righteousness will work in the midst of this kind of pain and anguish, then it will always work. If it proves true in this mess, then it's true, and everybody ought to trust it and hope in this that Job has told us. Now, throughout this book, we get a very clear message. The man-centered faith of the three friends doesn't work, not even on the best day. It doesn't work at all, and nobody should ever trust that system. The God-centered faith of Job does work, even on the very worst day. Even when Job thinks it's bad, it's still working. When God gives this kind of faith, it lasts forever. It works. Well, let's look at the first part of Job 16, first five verses. Then Job answered, "I have heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to windy words? Or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain." Now Job is replying to Eliphaz, who has just spoken, but he's really replying to all three of the people here that have been speaking. They've all had a turn. They're all in agreement on this idea of human manufactured righteousness. They're all sure that they're right. They're all sure that their lives are above reproach, and they're all sure they can produce righteousness and God will accept it. And they're all sure that if Job would just listen to them, his problems would straighten out. And so in this part of Job's reply, he's pointing out what's wrong with everything they've already said. I'm not going to try to go back over it. But he's saying, you guys are amazing. Your words proclaim great things, and your lives just don't measure up. From a human perspective and from a spiritual perspective, these three guys were complete flops. Their faith rests in themselves. They're unbelieving in a righteousness that comes from God. And so for them, even comfort and privilege and good health produced only vanity. That's what it is to be a slave to sin. The very best things produce emptiness. Even the best circumstances, someone who is a slave to sin is controlled by the sin and can't help anybody and can't help himself. Now, Job points out three things that are wrong with their lives. Or I see three in here anyway. The first is empty boasting. If these men had it together the way they thought they had it together, they would have been able to offer Job some comfort. They had each made some pretty impressive statements about their own godliness and about their own ability to help Job in his trouble. It all looks pretty empty, though, when you notice that they've got nothing. They haven't helped at all. They haven't encouraged Job at all. I mean, this is just one guy. And he's hurting really, really bad in many ways. So you'd think if three really godly guys get together and team up on him, they could do something to help. And who's going to notice that more than Job? Ease the pain just a little bit, and Job will know. But instead, as they've tried to help, they've actually done nothing but torment this poor guy who's already in pain. The one guy who would know if he had received any comfort. The one guy who would know if there was any rational basis for all of their claims to be the guys with the answers evaluates their ministry this way. Sorry comforters are you all. Now Job is sure that he could have done better. He's the one in misery. He can think of a lot of things that would have helped. Even though they couldn't make his trouble go away, they could have eased him in his discomfort. In verses 4 and 5, he says, "I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you." And then he shows what he also could do. "I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain." He's like, it's not that hard, guys. You're missing something here if you can't help even me because I'm in a mess. They had the position and the power to do something, and they were able to do nothing. Their condition as slaves to sin just led to empty boasting about themselves, but there was nothing to back it up. It also led to false hope. This is what is true for every slave of sin. They hope in things that are no hope at all. Now, the only earthly difference between Job and these three guys was circumstantial. Right then, at this point in their lives, these three guys have it really, really good. Job has it really, really bad. That's the only difference. It's all pretty temporary. But throughout their speeches, they have taken all of their hope from that fact. We have it good. And Job, you have it bad. Therefore, we must be right and you must be wrong. In fact, they claimed that life was good for them because they deserved it, and life was bad for Job because that's what he deserved. This is God's payoff to us all. We have it good, therefore we know God likes us. And you have it kind of bad, right? In fact, it's real bad, so we know God is really mad at you. Their status and privilege didn't produce any gratitude in their hearts toward God. Instead, it produced a claim that God was just being good to them because they were good. They deserved it. God's just paying them what they earned. Now, being a slave to sin makes you seek self-justification that way. Anything good and you think, well, I'm the one. I'm healthy and you're not, therefore I must be holier than you are. I'm prettier than you, I'm stronger than you, I'm more popular than you, therefore I know I'm godly. I must be more godly than you because I have it better than you. I know that God is blessing me because I have privileges you don't have. I like myself more than I like you. Therefore, I know I'm holy and you're not. It's that empty. You see this logic all the time. You see this in churches. This will creep into churches and ministries. A lot of people are coming. Therefore, we must be doing it right. It's like the Super Bowl, you know. You got a lot of people there. There's a sign that says John 3:16. God is blessing it. The stadium's full. Well, they say it about a church, you know. It's full, so it must be God. A lot of people agree with us, so we must be right. Now, reality works a little different, doesn't it? I mean, there are healthy people who are godly, and there are healthy people who are ungodly, and there are sick people who are godly, and there are sick people who are ungodly, and you can be strong and pretty and popular and be godly or not. And there are good churches that grow, and there are synagogues of Satan that grow. That's just not the test. Now, sometimes in churches, people realize there's a flaw in that, and so then they make the opposite error. This one's a lot of fun to watch. We must be godly because we're not growing at all. It can't possibly be that we're obnoxious people. It must be that we're really, really godly and we're on the narrow way. It's just not a valid test. Sometimes people suffer because they're being persecuted for godliness. Sometimes they suffer for some other reason. It's just not enough to go on. But these guys are putting all their hope in those circumstantial things. It's a false hope to look at what somebody else says about your life or thinks about your life, or to look at how many people agree with you, or to look at how happy you are with your point of view and say, therefore, God must agree with me. That's foolishness, but it's a common form of foolishness. There may be no correlation at all between any of those things and your godliness. That's not how you tell. You can't always take those things to mean anything in particular. Now, Job points this out with such incredible clarity in verse 4. When he says, I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. Now, this is the guy everybody is so down on. These three guys are sure Job is the worst scoundrel drawing breath. And Job says, yeah, you know, tomorrow, if I felt good and had a little money coming in, and, you know, these problems were just suddenly gone, then I could look down my nose and say the same thing, and you would have to accept it based on the philosophy you've been stating all through this interchange. It's that flimsy. Job's just got to have one good day, and suddenly he's godly, and he can look down his nose at them if they're having a bad day. Well, sin makes people look at all sorts of things that are not hope and take hope in them. You can't evaluate your standing with God on anything except what God says about you in His Scripture. He says a lot about how you live, about what you depend on, about whether you have a standard of holiness that permeates your life. If you don't have that, you're not right with Him. If you haven't bowed your heart before Christ and received the righteousness that comes from God, you're not right with Him, no matter who thinks you're a great person. But these men didn't believe in that kind of righteousness. They were slaves to sin, and so they had empty boasting and false hopes, and then they had sinful omissions. Sinful omissions. These guys had talked a good game. And if you read their stuff is often quoted by people as if it's right. It sounds pretty good on the surface. They know what they ought to be doing. They know enough about righteousness to know what they should be doing. They couldn't give such fine-sounding religious arguments if they didn't have the law of God written on their hearts. And so they know what they're required to do, and they know what is right. And when Job points out that they are sorry comforters, he is pointing out their guilt for failing to do what they know they should do and what they have already announced that they should do. In James chapter 4, verse 17, God tells us, "Therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin." These guys, with their empty boasting, had proven their own guilt before God. They knew enough of God's standard to be guilty. They might have used their position to give the comfort that they knew they should give, that they had claimed to give. And even a little bit of comfort would have been a huge relief to Job. But even that was lacking. They mocked him, they ridiculed him, they tormented him. They had completely failed to do what they knew they should do, what they had said they should do. This is just how it is. When sin is master over you, this is how it is. You can't do anything good. And so even in the best of circumstances, the best comforts, the best privileges, these men can only produce vanity. Empty lives, empty boasting, false hopes, sinful missed opportunities. They were slaves to sin. They were under its authority, and it had absolute power over them. And they, even on their best day, they could do nothing to overcome its power. That's what it is to be a slave. Now, what about Job? Job is a believer. If we use the lingo from Romans 6, we know from what God has told us about Job in chapters 1 and 2 that Job has been freed from sin and made a slave of righteousness. A slave. And this is the condition of everyone who serves God, everyone that God saves. So what we're looking at when we look at Job in these coming verses is where every one of you is if you're a Christian. Now in this story, we're seeing Job at his very worst, literally the worst moments of a lifetime, in the middle of suffering that is beyond description. His life stands as a testimony of what's true for every believer in the righteousness that comes from God. In such a person, even hardship and despair proves righteousness. And God uses that hardship to bring the righteous person closer to Himself. Let's pick up again in verse 6. Job says, "If I speak, my pain is not lessened. If I hold back, what has left me? But now He has exhausted me. You have laid waste all my company. You have shriveled me up, and it becomes a witness. My leanness rises up against me. It testifies to my face. His anger has torn me and hunted me down. He has gnashed at me with his teeth. My adversary glares at me. They have gaped at me with their mouth. They have slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They have massed themselves against me. God hands me over to ruffians and tosses me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me, and he has grasped me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. He has also set me up as his target. His arrows surround me without mercy. He splits my kidneys open. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks through me with breach after breach. He runs at me like a warrior. I have sewn sackcloth over my skin and thrust my horn in the dust. My face is flushed from weeping, and deep darkness is on my eyelids, though there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. Wow. This poor guy is absolutely miserable. And he's saying, nothing helps. If I complain, it doesn't help. If I hold back, I don't lose any of the pain. It's not helping either way. He believes that God is the one who has torn him apart, that God has looked at him with anger, that God has ridiculed him in the face of his adversaries. He believes that God has shattered his life and that God did it when Job was at ease and comfortable. And now there's no chance of it ever being good again. The thing that I would point out to you in the middle of all of this expression of grief that Job goes on and on with in this book is that he's still talking to God. Even in this, he's still working it out before the Lord. Job is really at the point in his life where he has nothing but God. There's nothing else. He doesn't understand. He doesn't believe that he can take any more. And yet all of his struggles drive him to God. He doesn't look to Eliphaz and say, man, just give me something that'll help. Bildad, man, don't you have anything? Zophar, come on, man. Tell me something that'll help. He's still going to God. He has nowhere else to go. That's what the disciples said to Jesus when he said, you guys leaving too? Where would we go? You have the words of eternal life. There's nothing else I can do. That's where he is. I've done all of this, and God, I have a problem with it, but I'm going to talk to you about it because there's nobody else to talk to. This is one of the ways that a person's life demonstrates what he really believes. This is one of the ways that being a slave to sin, a slave to righteousness, shows itself in a person's life. Where else are you going to go? There's nothing else. And so Job goes on. Look at verses 18 and 19. O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. Job longs for his life to be vindicated in this life. This is the guy who has prayed to die numerous times already in this book, and now he's saying, not yet. I want it straightened out. I want these guys to see that I'm right. I want to be vindicated. Don't let the grave cover me yet. And then he expresses this incredible hope in the midst of all of this conflict. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven and my advocate is on high. I know this much. God will speak for me in the end. I wish he would speak now. I'm trying to hang on until he'll vindicate me, but he will speak. God is my advocate. I can't defend myself before these guys, but here's my hope. I know God will defend me one day. One day. I don't understand, and I don't like it, but I do know this. Where else are you going to turn? You're going to turn to yourself like these three bozos have done? That's not going to help. And so the righteous just cry out to God, even in their anguish. Job is frustrated. He doesn't understand. He knows that God is the one doing all of this. He knows that God could have stopped it. He knows that God is making it this way. And so he goes on complaining, but he is talking to God. Pick up again in chapter 16, verse 20. My friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God. Oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor. And when a few years are past, I shall go the way of no return. My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For you have kept their heart from understanding. Therefore you will not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also will languish. But he has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will go stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying, the light is near in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father. To the worm, you are my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? Job recognizes that in all of his trouble, God is doing something. He knows God's doing it. He knows it isn't just happening. He knows the world isn't spinning out of control and that God has walked away. He doesn't understand it. He's saying some pretty strong things about how he doesn't like it. He doesn't appreciate what God is doing to him. But he does know God is doing it and that Job has no control over his circumstances. There's nothing he can do. Do you understand that this is what it is to be in the position of a slave? You don't have any control. You're not in charge of your own life. You're not orchestrating anything. That's where Job is, and he knows it. Even the blindness of his friends to the real condition of their own hearts and to his hearts, Job recognizes that comes from God. He has blinded his adversaries. God has blinded his adversaries to the real truth. In verse 4 of chapter 17, he says, for you have kept their heart from understanding. God is in control. They're not in control. They're slaves of sin. I'm not in control. I'm a slave of righteousness. God is doing all of this. Job is frustrated. He's frustrated because all of his plans have come to nothing. That's hard for us, isn't it? That's what the last part of this chapter is about. I had all of these plans. I had all of these dreams. All of it's come to nothing. That's hard to process on. Doesn't go like you hoped it would go. It's not turning out the way you would have planned. In fact, it's radically different from what you would wish for. That's what he's suffering under. Verse 15 of chapter 17, where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Not only have I lost it, but nobody even cares. They're just telling me I need to straighten up and work my way to heaven. Lost hopes and broken dreams and no explanations about why. That's what it is to be a slave. You don't get an answer to that. You wouldn't understand it anyway. The master doesn't owe it to you and won't give it to you. You're not getting an answer as to why. Maybe the most frustrating thing for Job is that he's just stuck. And he can't change any of it. There's nothing he can do. Look at verses 7 to 9 of chapter 17. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. Now, stop right there for a second. What he's saying is, look at my pitiful condition. It's so bad that the people who are upright think the worst of me. And the godly are stirring themselves up against me. Everybody's telling me I'm wrong to hope in God and to think that righteousness comes from Him. Everybody's down on me about this, and they're sure they're godly, and I'm not. And then look at verse 9. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. Now, Job is not necessarily thrilled about this pronouncement he's making. He's complaining. He's saying, there's nothing I can do. It would be so much easier if I could just walk away from my convictions and pretend that these guys are right so they will let up on me and I could have some peace. But I can't. Because God has touched my heart with these convictions, I can't change at all. I have to hold on to my way no matter what. He's saying, it's so bad. I'm so weary of crying. And I cannot acquiesce and pretend that my tormentors are right. But if I could, they would leave me alone. And I can't even have that. Because God is doing something that I don't understand. The righteous man holds his way. No matter what, you hang on to your convictions, you can't do anything else. It's what Paul said. You know, he was always in jail for what he said. He's always in trouble for what he said. Paul said, we believed, therefore we spoke. What else can you do? It's your conviction. God changed your heart. You can't do anything else. Job is so constrained by what God has done in his heart that he goes on suffering for the sake of righteousness and becomes stronger and stronger in his convictions in the midst of all of this pain and anguish, even as he suffers the torment of his best friends pointed at him. And this in the very worst moments of his life. This is how it is for the righteous. The righteous will hold his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. We are slaves of righteousness. We can't change what God is doing in our lives. Even in those foolish moments when we want to change it, we can't change it. We're not the master. This is what Jeremiah was talking about when he complained that he didn't like the message that he was called to preach. And then he said, but I try to hold it in, and it's like fire in my bones. And I couldn't restrain it. I don't like it. But I can't shut up about it, because if I try to hold it in, it burns me up. This is what Asaph was talking about in Psalm 73 when he says, if I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have betrayed the generation of your righteous children. Asaph had complained for the first 14 verses of that psalm that it's better for the wicked. You know, it's so much easier for them. They don't ever have any of these problems. And then he says in verse 15, you know, if I had said that, if I had said, I'm just going to proclaim this, it's easier if you don't have to fool with all these convictions, I would have betrayed everybody who loves the Lord, and I know it, and so I couldn't say that. This is where you are if you're a slave to righteousness. He knew it would be a lie, and so he was stuck. And Job is stuck. He can't change his circumstances. He can't change his friends. He can't change his convictions. He just has to go along for the ride no matter where it goes. Even when he's frustrated in every way with what God is doing in his life, he can't change what he knows to be true. And what he can't see yet that we can see, because we got the whole story, is that God is doing a wonderful work in his life. He just doesn't appreciate it. He just doesn't know it. All he knows is, man, I don't like the way this feels. We have the book of Job, so we can remind ourselves, well, God's doing something good. I just don't know what it is. That helps us. But what a picture of the difference between being a slave of sin and being a slave of righteousness. Everybody's a slave to something. Everybody's in one condition or the other. For the unbeliever, nothing in their lives will ever make them seek God. All it does is exalt them in themselves until the judgment. Even their comforts and their privileges lead them to reject God as they worship themselves. And for the believer, everything drives you to God. Even the stuff you hate the most, God is using to work a purpose in your life to bring you closer to Him. He's got you. You're stuck. He's doing something in your life And no matter what happens, God is going to work his good purpose in you. Even if you go kicking and screaming like Job is doing in the middle of this book, he's still going to do good to you. Even when you don't understand. Even when you don't think you like it. Even when you don't handle it very well. God is doing a good work in the lives of his children. Even trouble and hardship strengthen you in your convictions and cause you to turn to God. Where else are you going to turn? You're a slave of righteousness. Two very different kinds of people. But one important message to each kind of person. There's a message in this book to everybody listening. If you're an unbeliever in the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith, then the message of the book of Job, and particularly of these two chapters, is you don't know God at all. You don't know him. You can throw that word around like you don't have any idea what he's like if you haven't submitted your heart to him. And everything in your life adds to your guilt before him. And your only hope is to forsake self and to seek the righteousness that comes from God. Believe that Jesus Christ's death on the cross is all that is necessary to produce that righteousness in you, and then you'll be saved, and then you come to know God. You have to receive righteousness from him. If you're an unbeliever, that's the message. That's where you have to start. Stop hoping in yourself. Bow before your Maker and beg for his mercy. If you're a believer, and this book has a frightening, perhaps, but very important message for you. You don't know God nearly as well as you're going to. And God is going to work every problem and every frustrating event in your life and every issue that you don't like until you know him more and more and more. By the way, there'll also be lots of good things. They're just not in this chapter. These two chapters. You don't know God like you're going to know him. And he doesn't need your consent. He's not looking for you to understand first. He's not going to tell you why it's happening when it happens to you. But if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, then God is going to draw you to himself more and more and more. And you're going to know him like you don't know him today. Sometimes he'll even take away all of your hopes so that you can realize that at rock bottom, it's you and God, and that's enough. If you're a believer, you don't know him like you're going to know him. Trust him. Let's pray.